on weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to the two Johnnies in Africa for the afternoon entertainment. It is Tuesday, May 21st, and you are listening to Game On with me, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh. Coming up between now and 7pm, David Snade reflects on Shelburne's late, late shows. The League of Ireland leader stunned Pats with a 96th minute winner. And Rovers regroup with a win over fellow title contenders Derry City. Mark Langdon will join the football conversation to wrap up all of the news across Europe and look forward to a Europa League final tomorrow night in Dublin.
In the words of my co-host, who I assume bounced out of Talca Park last night, we will stick with association football and we'll hear from international Ireland international Megan Campbell ahead of next week's Euro qualifier against Sweden in the Aviva. Fran Berry is going to join us to look ahead to the Irish Guinness Festival at the Curragh this weekend, and Austin O'Malley is in studio to review the opening fixtures in the group stage of the All-Ireland Football Championship.
We'll also be speaking to cycling journalist Shane Stokes ahead of this year's Ross that begins tomorrow. So lots to look forward to over the course of the next hour. And if you want to have your say in any of that or whatever else besides, you can text us on 51552, WhatsApp 0871879200, or we are on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Right, David Snade, you might as well get this out of the way good and early. How good were Shells last night? Just tell Shane Dawson they were... incredible. Just keep him on that high. He's just bouncing around the studio. Just keep him there, David.
No, I was greeted with a hug when I came into the studio earlier, which I know. And you were saying there, Ruby, that he was bouncing out of Richmond Park. I actually know for a fact that he wasn't, because he was on Twitter straight away to put up a gif of Pat Dolan from back in the day, just on the wind-up, you know. Because in fairness, he was only telling me there, what was it, 211 Shells fans at a match in Kildare? So
no, so Shelburne Waterford in 07 when the club was on the brink of extinction.
Yeah.
We've come a long way.
It's, in fairness, it is, and even Damien Duff has been saying it over the last little while, and about, you know, all the kind of mementos of 2008 and around that time, and of 2006, sorry. Mm. And like, it is, Ruby, in fairness, like, that's one of the benefits, obviously, in League of Ireland, especially in the press box from Richmond Park. I was covering the game last night. Like, you are very close, and it's been evident for the last couple of years, but again, it was just there again. Like, you just see the charisma and the aura that Damien Duff has as a manager, and not just in terms of the kind of intensity he has on a touchline, but just how he brings his players and his everyone along with him, and just the buy-in that he has got, and just the drive that's there amongst them. Because for Shells to be at this point of the table, halfway through the season, to be top of the table, 6 points clear of Shamrock Rovers, was a four clear of Derry as well after Derry lost last night. It really is incredible. Like, they probably have a budget in maybe the top five, possibly could even be stretching to six in the league. And he's got a squad of players there who individually you wouldn't think, oh yeah, I'll definitely have him in my team, I'll definitely want him in my team. But collectively now, what he's been doing has just been, it's just been consistent improvement from the time, obviously, when he took over, when Ian Morris had actually got them promoted, and then obviously staying up, getting to a cup final, then qualifying for Europe, and now definitely without a shadow of a doubt in with a chance of winning a league title. And there really is just a kind of energy around Shelbourne, and it's not even just that, it's like that, I was going to go with the Neil Diamond song, the Travelling Salvation Show. It's kind of like Damien Duff brings it around everywhere in the country, because you can't help but get swept up in it, you know.
What way does he go to Tala then on Friday night, take on Rovers? Is he going there thinking, ooh, we get out of here with a draw, we're still rolling, or does he go all guns blazing?
I don't think he'll go all guns blazing in the sense of being stupid about it. He's a pragmatic manager. Like, there was shouts in the Pats end yesterday towards him, which you would have heard, because obviously the fans are so close, that it was like watching Jack Charlton football from back in the day. But it was Sean Boyd
is our Tony Cascarino.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
The same Jack Charlton that got us to the World Cup. Yeah.
Well, I was literally going to make the point. Like, it's to a degree. Some of it is very simple, but that's because you have a goalkeeper like Conor Cairns, and Damien Duff has spoken about this. You've got a goalkeeper like Conor Cairns who can pass the ball 60-70 yards with a force and with an accuracy that isn't just putting it into space. It's like there's a plan behind it, and then, like, it was very clear, like, some of the second balls they win them. And then the players they have, Liam Bourke, who's on loan from Shamrock Rovers, you've obviously got Will Jarvis, who's in there. Like, you've got these players who are so technical, and can, when they sweep up those second balls, can be such a threat in the final third. And it just makes more sense to play at times that way, because there was also moments, especially in the second half, on the counter attack, and this is to go into your question, Ruby, about how they can go at it, where with Mark Coyle, with JJ Looney, there obviously will be that doubt.
So that's the Donegal Cambiasso, not
Mark Coyle. Is that because he has a skinhead now? as well. But they've done it already. Shells where they've been gone to Tallaght Stadium and scored them and being impressive. You could see them causing Rovers trouble on the break. I can well imagine that the stats possession wise at the weekend on Friday, should I say, will be maybe 65, possibly even higher in Shamrock Rovers' favour. And I think Shelburne will be very comfortable with that. But they'll do it in a sense where even the fans, not just because they're top of the league now, and even the players, where they buy into it because they deal with a purpose and intensity. And it's not just parking the bus and then like almost being laboured and sluggish and, as you say, kind of hoping, oh, will they get out with a draw? It's believing that they know they have that capability when they do get the chance that they'll punish teams. Like Stephen Bradley, the Rovers manager, was speaking a couple of weeks ago after one of their games, when obviously they had just come off the back of a defeat to Waterford, and then there was talking about, you know, we don't have any worries about this because we know our XG is high and stuff, and he was kind of talking about the stats and maybe hinting that the XG and some of the stats and might not be kind of in Shelburne's favour over the course of over the full season. But sometimes, and even like last night, you get those moments, a last minute winner, where it just kind of adds an extra little bit of impetus in a point in the season where you might feel a bit of a lull, like Shells had gone on a period of 7-8 games where they didn't win. Or I think it was one win in nine. And they were still at top because they had such a great start. And you're going to have those periods during the season where maybe everything isn't going to go up to plan, and a team like Shells, where you do play, you kind of play on the edge and you have those fine margins, it's not always going to go for you. But the last couple of games now, back to back, you've got, mentioned Sean Boyd there, like he's got 4 goals in 4 games. He is that talisman turning into it. And again, you could see him making a 5-5, especially the history he coming through at Shamrock Rovers and having a really bad injury and fighting for his career. And I think there's a person who kind of sums up Damien Duff's personality and fight and drive and will to kind of forge a career for yourself. I think Sean Boyd is one of those type of players, you know. And there's, as much as there'll be people who aren't Shells fans, like, you can't help but admire what Damien Duff is doing. You know, he really is getting a group of players together and making them believe and dragging them along with it, and it's just really impressive to see.
I think even UEFA, I think, had an article on the so-called greatest league in the world and put that quote to Damien Duff, because he did say it. But credit to a Pats fan, Dodge on Twitter, who I think did coin that many years ago.
But that was always the ironic thing, isn't it? I know what you're saying. You see it on social media. It'd be one of those where, and we've had greatest league in the year moments this year, like Sligo Rovers, where the match is delayed because there's like Astro laid in the goal mouth and the referee and some of the stuff. And that would be what you would call, say, the like greatest league in the world. Yeah. Stuff. Whereas now, like when Damien Duff is saying it, you know, he's kind of maybe getting that little bit. If that would have been said, and that little bit of a hint of
tongue,
it's a strange one. It'd be a mix of an inferiority complex, but at the same time feeling superior to anybody else who thinks that what they do is a better way of watching football and living your life as a football fan, you know. And whereas now, when you hear Damien Duff and the kind of the caliber of person he is in Irish football and what he achieved in English football, winning 2 Premier League trophies with Chelsea and Mourinho, when you hear him talking in such a way and with such a passion about it, it does not necessarily people who have been involved with the League of Ireland or who love the League of Ireland would have needed that kind of vindication or satisfaction or whatever from it. But on the outside, when you have someone like Damien Duff speaking so passionately about Irish football and how it is the way forward in terms of, especially now, whatever with Brexit and all the rest of it, and how developing players, it just adds another element of kind of credence to it, I suppose, you know.
Absolutely, it is great to see the little product on the centre stage.
But also the best goal of the match was Jake Mulroney's free kick for St. Pat's.
Could I ask one small question?
It wasn't a 96-minute winner, but yeah, technically, I suppose. Sorry, Ruby.
One small question for a non-League of Ireland brain box. How come Shells have played Rovers twice at home already and then have played them twice away? How come it's not alternative?
Yeah, no, so basically what's happened this year was because of the European game. So I think it's to do with basically, it's even if you look at it, even the games last night when it was obviously Pats and Shells, and you have Rovers Derry. Obviously, their 4 teams are going to be in Europe later on in the summer, and so it's just a case of maybe freeing up a little bit of times in the schedule and just kind of switching it up. So yeah, there was that time where obviously Shells have already played Rovers twice at Tolka Park, and now it'll be there. So it was just basically in a strange case, Ruby. It was actually clubs working together in European football, who are going to be involved in European football, to hopefully do something whereby it might help improve the possibility of clubs going a bit further in the summer.
So halfway point for the European clubs, 16 matches played for the other clubs at the moment. Just on the League of Ireland women's side of things, news on the Avenir All-Ireland Cup quarter-final draw just taking place. Linfield will take on Wexford, Rovers will host Piemont, Shells will go against Athlone, and Galway take on Treaty United. Sinead for domestic football, Mark Langdon is on the line to broaden the conversation on football. And begin with, we're already looking forward to the Euros because England and Scotland, a few others, have named their provisional squads in the Euros. Mark, no Marcus Rashford, no Jordan Henderson in the England squad, I suppose, is the news. And it's a squad as well that has plenty of variety for players playing across Europe and different clubs as well.
Yeah, I mean, a very large squad named by Gareth Southgate in terms of sort of, you know, you've got to whittle that down to 26 players early next month. I think there are some sort of key fitness doubts. That's probably the reason why he's named as many players as he has. But I think there was some surprise that Rashford and Henderson were particularly were left out. I think Reece James just hasn't played enough football this season. Obviously a quality right back, but it's a position where England have got a lot of depth anyway. But, you know, Southgate has been very loyal to sort of the established squad members during his time. You think of something like Harry Maguire that, you know, wasn't playing for Manchester United and was ridiculed by even his supporters, and yet Southgate was, steadfast in his belief that he was the right person to have in the squad. You know, Henderson, there were probably calls from outside for him not to be in the England squad a couple of years ago, and for the last, ever since then, really. And still, Southgate has selected him, even when he went to Saudi Arabia and all the controversy around that. He hasn't been fully fit, I suppose, for enough of the season at Ajax, but I'm still surprised just because of how loyal Southgate is. Rashford, on the face of it, I don't think deserves to be in the squad. His performances for Manchester United have not been up to the standard of those that are playing in those positions for England that are in the squad. But again, you know, this was a player that had done very well for Southgate previously, joint top scorer for England at the last World Cup, can play in multiple forward positions. And so from that point of view, it was a surprise that he's kind of gone on club form rather than sort of the international form, which has been very much the trademark during his tenure so far.
Did any of the UNCLAP players surprise you, Mark? Curtis Jones, Jarrell Quensa, even Adam Wharton?
I think that there's been a sort of growing clamour for Wharton to be involved. Crystal Palace finished the season so well. He was instrumental in that from the central midfield area. I know sort of Eze and Elise have been fantastic as well, but he has come on a lot in the last couple of months, and it might be a position that England are short in, but I was still surprised that he made that jump. I don't think he'll be in the 26 sort of man squad that is named. I think he might be one of those that misses out, and it could be a case of Southgate just having a look at him for future. But that name came pretty much nowhere, really. I mean, I don't think anybody would have suggested he would have been playing for sort of, you know, England 6 weeks ago, apart from the most loyal of Crystal Palace fans. Konsa, I think, has deserved it, given how well he's been playing for Liverpool. And, you know, if you're starting for Liverpool, then you should be good enough for England. But he wasn't really mentioned in media reports sort of over the last week, speculation about who would be in the squad and who would be out. His name wasn't brought up sort of with any kind of frequency. I fully believe that Curtis Jones should be in that squad. I'd even have him in the 26 as well. I thought before his injury at Brentford, he was outstanding for Liverpool, and, you know, potentially one of the reasons why it started to go wrong for Liverpool was when he wasn't the only one, but that they picked up some injuries, didn't they? And I thought he was playing at a very high level for Liverpool before that injury. Don't think he's come back from it quite so well, but Southgate clearly liked what he saw, so I'm fully supportive of that selection. I think Jones was brilliant as well for the under 21s last year when they won the Euro, so I'm fully behind that call up.
Europa League final tomorrow night in the Dublin Stadium, as it will be officially known tomorrow. Bayer Leverkusen looking to maintain their invincible season against Atalanta, who are banging form as well. Will Bayer Leverkusen remain Bayer never losing?
Yeah, I mean, it's the most remarkable story of this season and potentially of any other season as well. First team in German football history to go through the season unbeaten. They wrapped up the title to go, but just had that sort of final sort of bit to add to the season. They've got a second division team, Kaiserslautern, in the German Cup final. So, you know, I couldn't see them losing that game. So this could be it between them and, you know, an invincible season would be just phenomenal. Like you maybe Bayern Munich, you'd think could be able to do that in terms of German teams, but never losing, as you alluded to there. Of course, that's a play on the fact that they used to be called Neverkusen because would always fall short when the trophies were handed out and were seen as a bit of sort of bottlers, essentially, in German football. That's all changed under Xabi Alonso. You've got people like Granit Xhaka playing fantastically well for them. Jonathan Tah, centre-half, that is going to start for Germany at the Euros. Florian Wirtz, young player, anybody that's going to the game tomorrow, he's definitely one to watch out for. The sort of German national team are sort of pinning their hopes on him, I think, being the next golden boy of German football, playmaker that can win back possession and then uses it very well. I'm giving them the big build-up. I don't think this is an easy game against Atalanta. Anybody that watched them play against Liverpool, the way they dismantled sort of Liverpool Anfield, will know that this side can play. Gasperini, a very bold coach. He goes man for man all over the pitch. Ten Hag tries to do that for Manchester United and gets it horribly wrong. Gasperini has kind of coached the team to play it better. That they're going to press and press and press again. They've got good quality all over the pitch. A very small team by sort of, you know, Italian standards, and not one that you'd expect to see necessarily in the European final. They've already qualified for next season's Champions League, courtesy of a top five finish in Italy. They're the outsiders, but I wouldn't put it past them causing an upset here. I think they're a very talented side.
So it's a bit of a blow, the fact that they've lost Doreen as well through injury, but I kind of agree with you in the sense that I think, like, Atalanta, if there's a team who are left in it, considering everyone can see what they did to Liverpool and how they basically dismantled Liverpool at Anfield, like, when was the last time you saw anyone be able to capable of doing that? But I think there's a bit more of a romance and a bit more of a kind of, I think a lot of people would have a bit of a grow for even Alonso and Leverkusen, because, like, normally what would happen in this situation is that you see what he's doing as this young manager and he would have been picked off by a so-called bigger club, obviously, and he would have left. That team would have been dismantled. It's pretty much what's happened year after year, and mostly it probably would have been Bayern Munich doing it, or whoever it was. You know, there was talks, obviously, that Alonso was going to be going to Liverpool when that job came up, but the fact that even he made the point of saying, no, I'm going to stay here, he doesn't want to just jump at the first opportunity, he's probably backing himself to say, well, this, I think, let's be honest, like, having this type of season where you go unbeaten, it'll be incredible if he can replicate that, but being able to build on it and actually be successful again, he's kind of backing himself to do that with this group of players. And you kind of see those, you see those clips over the weekend, you see them on social media about the kind of the affinity that the fans now have for him, and even the connection that seems to be there. Like, it's just, it's so hard not to kind of get behind that and see that he didn't just have the chance to just jump and then go, you know.
Yeah, it'll be a great game. That is, of course, tomorrow night, Bayer Leverkusen versus Atalanta. Mark Langdon, thank you very much for taking our call. We're going to change sports now and move on to horse racing, because this weekend, of course, is the Irish Guineas Festival at the Curragh. Three great days racing. Evening begins on Friday evening with an evening meeting at 4:45. Saturday at 1:20, including the 2,000 Guineas, the Greenland Stakes, the Marble Hill and the Arby Stakes. And then on Sunday, it concludes again at 1:25, start with eight races, two Group 1s, including the Tattersalls Gold Cup and the Tattersalls Irish 1,000 Guineas, the Landway Stakes and the Gallanewl. And to have a look ahead at it, Fran Berry has joined us on the line. Fran, Guineas weekend, first of the Irish Classics. Always a good one in County Kildare.
Yeah, it is, Ruby. Yeah, it's really exciting. You know, when you get into the end of May, you've obviously had the UK Guineas run earlier this month, but all roads, week to week from now on, once you get the Irish Guineas up and running, it all builds a narrative through the flat season. So really looking forward to it, and if the weather stays kind, as it's due to, we should have an exciting weekend's racing.
Do you think the Kipco 2000 Guineas form from Newmarket at the beginning of the month holds the key to the Irish 2000 Guineas? Rosalian and Hotem of Richard Hannan's, they're both, they're still left in, don't know if they'll both run, but is that the key form line?
key form line based on that run and overall their last year's form as well. Both of them very smart horse in their own right. And for me, I think Rosalie, the way he ran when he was second to Notable Speech in the Guineas, was a very, very good effort. Notable Speech was an unexposed horse going into the race on turf, having won the all-weather. But Rosalie lost little in defeat. I thought there was a lot to like about the way he went through the race. And even you'd think perhaps the Curra, which wouldn't be as undulating, perhaps as Newmarket, should bring out another level of form in this horse. So I think based on that run in Newmarket, he sets a very, very good standard at the top of the market. The other hand and runner Hatim, maybe it just could be a couple lengths again behind his stable companion, but it's a very good horse in his own right. The unknown quantities, if you like, are the Edith O'Brien entries at present. Where do they fit in? Have they progressed from 2 to 3? And what's going to be the Mount Rye Moor in the race?
Which one would you think it'll be? I mean, Henry Longfellow was disappointing in Longchamp behind Metropolitan, and then he got the 1-2 for the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. Unquestionable Mountain Bear. Maybe River Tiber gets in there as well. It's probably a hard question to ask you, but which one of them would you have thought as a 2-year-old you'd be riding in the 2000 Guineas?
At the moment, I would favour River Tiber. I think he's really interesting, stepping up in distance. I just think if I see Ryan Moore's name penciled in beside him on the Friday evening declarations, I think he's the horse I'd like to be with. Henry Longfellow, France, Edith O'Brien's horses on their seasonal debut in April and early part of May seem to be lacking a run, maybe not quite up to their peak, is the theory. We'll find out more as to that, if that is the theory, if he's a proper Group 1 horse. Now, he did have a very good performance winning National Stakes last year, and maybe we didn't see the best in France, the more galloping nature and a straight track at the Curra, relatively straight track at the Curra, should suit him very well. But jockey arrangements are going to be key to Edith O'Brien's team. Whichever Ryan Moore is on, you'd imagine is the one showing up best on the gallops this week.
Well, we won't find that out until Thursday morning, I'm afraid. On Sunday, we have a pair of Group 1s. We'll start with the Tattersalls Gold Cup, Fran, and this looks like a pedestrian march for August Road End.
It does, if the real August Road End pitches up, and that is the question. This is when he's good, he's very, very good. But as we've seen in Dubai, he can throw in. There's no in between with this horse. He obviously bombed out in English 2000 Guineas last year. He went to Epsom. He was very good in the Epsom Derby. He got beat in between times at Ascot, and then he won the Irish Champion Stakes in great style, followed by that great run in America when he won. But his season debut in Maidan was back to where he started last year in English 2000 Guineas. Much too bad to be true. There seems to be no in between with this horse at all. He's either very, very good or totally bad. And you'd like to think, with the home town advantage running into Curra 10 furlongs with a decent surface, we'll see the real August Road End on Sunday. No reason you'd hope that we don't. Maybe Dubai, it came too soon the year for him, but he's got questions to answer as a 4-year-old here. But as we've seen in the past, he can often resurrect himself and perform to a very high level.
He can indeed. The Tattersalls 1000 Guineas is next up on Sunday afternoon. Port of Fortuna and Fallen Angel reopposed from Newmarket. Paddy Toomey, a Lilac Roller and Purple Lily, Vesper Tilio for William McCreary, or maybe Opera Singer for Aidan O'Brien. It's a competitive renewal, Fran.
Cracking race and a great variety of trainers in the race. For listeners, Paddy Toomey, definitely a name to know. He's got a Lilac Roller, who's 3 from 3. She won a trial race at Leopardstown in April in really good style. And Purple Lily, who may well have got beaten by a longer distance at Navan recently, she's a very good filly also in her own right. And Paddy Toomey is a young, relatively young, up-and-coming trainer. He's only been trained 6 or 7 years, and these are two big standard bears for him. And I would not be surprised to see either of them win based on their form. But Opera Singer, trained by Aidan O'Brien, has really good juvenile form also. She's missed a lot of the spring. She's coming here after a bit of a setback. So if she's at 110% of her best or 100% of her best, she should be very competitive. But you have that worry, given the time that she's missed, she may not be at her peak. And for me, I do like the two Toomey runners, and it'd be interesting to see which stable jockey Billy Lee will elect to ride. I think at present I'd be going with a Lilac Roll. I think she's quite exciting at the mile distance. And Port of Fortuna and Fallen Angel. Fallen Angel was a Group 1 winner at the Curra last year. Didn't perform up to expectations in the English 1000 Guineas, but her and Port of Fortuna, who's just beat in the English Guineas, they're two very good fillies. They're all right. Great spread of trainers, great spread of horses with chances in the 1000 Guineas.
It most certainly will be. Fran, we're only 12 days out from Epsom, the Derby, City of Troy, the big talking horse all winter, blew out in the 2,000 guineas. He's on course for Epsom. Are you a believer or a doubter?
I'm a bit of a doubt in Thomas at present. Obviously, Aidan O'Brien, what he did last year, resurrecting Augusto Rodan after that very poor showing in the 2,000 guineas to get him back and win at Epsom. He may well do it again. His Damned Together Forever of City of Troy was a very good mare in her own right, who liked Epsom. And City of Troy, to me last year, I didn't see him as a Derby horse in my own head. I thought he was a real mild 10 furlong horse. Now, on the back of a very poor run in the 2,000 guineas, he's going right up in trip. He's going to a trip that I didn't think he'd run up, but connections obviously do. It's a very open year for the Epsom Derby. There's no real standout horse. You're going in what he did last year. Total respect for connections, but I'd be very happy to watch on and see how the race develops. And if he does produce the performances that he was capable of last season, he could be different class to these. But a stable companion, Ruby, Los Angeles, he's 3 from 3. He's likely to be the stable second selection in Epsom. For me, I think he's the ideal horse for the race there, and he could be the best of the Aidan O'Brien runners for me at the current odds.
Well, there is a dark one. On that note, Fran Berry, go and enjoy Brian Adams. Thanks a million for taking our call. We're going to take a quick break.
RTE 2FM. Game on 2FM.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On. Austin O'Malley is with us to chat Gaelic football. Before we do, though, a couple of news headlines. We usually do them at the top of the show, but we dive straight into the League of Ireland, understandably. Munster's Simon Zeebo has announced that he will retire from rugby at the end of the season. Zeebo is the province's record try scorer with 72 in 173 appearances to date. And mixed news for Irish rowers. Good news, the Irish women's four of Emily Hegarty, Natalie Long, Emer Lamb and Imogen Magner will fight for an Olympic medal after securing a place in Paris at the final qualification regatta. However, disappointment for Sunita Pushpure, who missed out on a fourth consecutive Olympic appearance after misfortune struck, and she finished fifth in the women's singles schools A final. A disappointment as well for Conan Pazia, who was sixth in the men's singles schools A final. But as I mentioned, Gaelic football, Austin O'Malley is with us. Austin, big weekend as well, but start with the news line for Mayo as well. Good win over Cavan, however, big blow, Paddy Durkin out. How will that affect Mayo?
Look, it's a huge, huge blow. You know, you'd have to feel really sorry for the guy. He's put down, I suppose, a year that he's been sort of dogged with the reoccurrence of a calf injury. And, you know, he came on late in that game, and to see him hobble off there at the end as, I suppose, Mayo fans were making their way onto the pitch. And I just knew at the time it didn't look good, but can't be underestimated. Like, he's a massive, massive player for Mayo. He's our captain, he's their leader, and he's a guy that, you know, when games are in the melting pot, he has consistently stood up. And he's a guy that I'm always saying has kind of great game awareness and what you would nearly say situational sensing in terms of when a big moment or a big play is needed. It's generally Paddy Durkin that has stepped up, and not alone his sort of ability to transition ball from back to front and get Mayo on the front foot, but you know the crucial scores that he's hit as well. So it's a huge, huge loss, you know, and it leaves a little bit of a void.
You stand on the first round of the All-Ireland Football Championship. We had a training game in Killarney. Cavan never really looked like landing a blow against Mayo. Cork and Kerr was close, Galway and Derry, obviously that red card. What did you make of the first weekend as a whole?
Yeah, overall, I suppose, looking at the games, when you look at the, you know, there's some sizeable wins, like obviously Mayo done a number on Cavan. When you look at the Kerry Monaghan game, it was largely a non-event for you know, long periods, 16-2 at the break. And I think even in the words of Vinnie Corey afterwards, he said it was probably the worst half hour of football that he'd ever seen Monaghan play. So there was a lot of mixed affair. It was interesting, the three northern teams were beaten over the weekend as well. So like, it kind of leaves you in, like, not that there's shadow boxing, but there's teams, I suppose Galway look like they're coming into a little bit of form, that they're beginning to shake themselves coming out of, I suppose, which was a troublesome National League, where in the words of their own John Concannon, you know, they were injury ravaged and they were training with only like 14 a night, and they've got everybody back now. So a lot of mixed affair, you know, a lot of mixed stuff. But I thought overall the weekend, I suppose the big surprise would be, you know, the lack of a performance by Derry, even though that game was, I suppose, punctuated by by the fact that, you know, the Garrett McKinless card, you know, did alter the complexion of it. But a lot of mixed affair. I don't think we're any the wiser over maybe some teams. Although the only thing I would say, maybe the Kerry game, just looked at, there was a little bit of a change in terms of maybe their setup and how defensively, you know, cohesive they were as a unit. They really blocked off that centre channel and they were committing huge numbers going forward. So Jack O'Connor definitely has worked on some stuff since the Munster final. So there are little bits and pieces that are of difference around that. But overall, I still think it'll come down to the big three, which will be, you know, the Dublin, Kerry, and I think Donegal will be in the mix.
Will Cork take the most out of the weekend, looking at the fixtures, assuming that the so-called big teams will finish in the top three? So you'd imagine Donegal, Tyrone would finish in the top three in that group as well. So Cork, Clare was that kind of shootout.
Yeah, and I think look, Cork lived very dangerously for a long period of that game. Even though, you know, they were up by 6 points at one stage, allowed Clare back into the game, ran their bench late, got a couple of good scores from Stephen Sherlock and Mark Cronin came in and seen it out. But you know, some of their old failings came back to haunt them again. I thought some of the stuff that we've seen early doors in the National League, like just not being, you know, not having a killer mentality up front, dropping free short, hit the crossbar, they were ragged looking, you know. So but obviously that performance, I think, was probably enough to put them to a Premier League quarter final, given that you think Clare probably won't have enough ammunition to down a Donegal or an Armagh, Donegal or
Who knows?
And I have to be very honest here now, Austin. I have become a Tailteann Cup fan, seen as Kildare now in the Tailteann Cup.
He's a Gaelic football hipster. That's what he is
a hipster. I'm a fan myself.
I move from one to the other.
Yeah.
So I do pay attention to what's going on at the bottom now.
Some cracking games.
We are there. There were some great games, but again, some huge margin of victories.
Yeah.
Obviously, teams from Division 4 struggling against teams higher up. Again, you wonder, is the balance quite right?
Yeah, look, I suppose when you look in, you know, on the balance of it, and you see Kildare 5-15, Waterford 6 points, and you kind of think, God, you know, who's is there anyone winning there really? But I suppose that's the structure that they're
down
in.
London, the same.
Yeah, London got a nice thump in there. I suppose 124, and I think it was 10 they only put up. So, like those games, definitely they're not serving the weaker counties in any ways, and that's a little bit of a mismatch we have at the moment. But I suppose it's all we have at the moment, and like I suppose on the other side of it, you look at then, you know, there's a bit of a cracker served up between Longford and Leitrim. It went to distance there, 1 point victory for Leitrim.
A punter was saying next week, huge news next week. Adrian Eames actually was saying, RT reporter, that the Leitrim fan went up to him and said that win means as much to Leitrim as an All-Ireland would to Dublin, and he was being sincere about it, about just how big that was.
Yeah, like, I mean, they've, you know, obviously they're knitted in close, the geography of them there coming in together, but it's always a huge one. It's always one, even, you know, if they're both are operating out of the basement in Division 4, or whether there's, you know, 1 and 2 or 1 and 4, like it's always really keenly contested. And I think it was McNulty free at the end that, you know, that he swung over to edge it. So another tight one there as well, obviously, like Wexford and Antrim. Great win for Antrim. Like that's a very, you know, I would think Wexford have a lot about them this year. They've showed a lot of good form. So 17-150, another 1 point victory there. So there has been close games, but you're right, Ruby, there has been a couple of mismatches there. And I suppose one that, looking in from my perspective, that I'm kind of wondering about is Offaly. You know, beaten again by Limerick. I think that's Limerick's first victory all season. Wow. if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, they're taking out 2-10-8, and, you know, Offaly, obviously they were previously beaten by London as well. So yeah, you just wonder, after, you know, that great All-Ireland under 20 success, that, you know, that hasn't seemed to sort of come through yet. But like you, Ruby, I've been your corner. I do keep abreast of it, and I think there are some quality games in it, but obviously, as you said, there is some mismatches there as well.
One useless stat for you, Austin. Offaly were the only away team to lose at the weekend.
Oh, nice one.
All of the other 7 away teams won.
One.
Which means Limerick was the only home team.
Home team.
So obviously, crowds are small at the Tailteann Cup, and maybe home advantage isn't what it is in the Championship.
Yeah, you don't know. And sometimes, look, I know as a player, sometimes you love to get on the road, you know, get on a bus, and it sort of builds a bit of spirit, and, you know, you can kind of get your energy levels up and that. So that could be a factor. But that's a nice one, Stato.
on that stat, Austin O'Malley, thank you very much for popping into the studio. We are taking a short break.
Thanks, guys.
Shane Stokes and cycling still to come, but up next, we have a feature interview with Megan Campbell, Republic of Ireland International.
Game on.
Football.
Now, Pepsi Max is set to light up Grand Canal Square in Dublin with the Pepsi Max hidden pitch, unlocking an unforgettable moment for football fans in an area where they'd least expect it. Passers-by will have the opportunity to grab a Pepsi Max football from a specially made vending machine, unlocking an epic laser display 2v2 pitch projection onto the street. One night only, tonight, from 9pm to 11pm, if you are in the Grand Canal Square area. Get down. The hidden pitch will offer onlookers the opportunity to engage in an unconventional style of gameplay, redefining the boundaries of the beautiful game. So with thanks to Pepsi Max, I'm delighted to say that Ireland international Megan Campbell joins us on the line now. Megan, how are you?
I'm not too bad, Shane. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat. Listen, let's just dive straight into our conversation. We are already looking forward to a big night in the Viva Stadium next week, welcoming Sweden in a Euro qualifier. Looking forward to linking back up with the Ireland squad?
Yeah, if selected, obviously. Nothing's been announced yet, but fingers crossed, if selected, I would love to be back in and around it again, definitely with the team.
We're assuming you'll be back. No doubt you'll be back with the performances to date. Listen, I know I asked you at the start, how are you? But given the injuries you've overcome throughout your career, I think it's nearly essential to ask in any interview you do, how is the body at the moment and how are you feeling and how are you feeling being back on the pitch now regularly?
Yeah, I'm 100% at the moment. I'm feeling really good, fit, getting better daily. I'm obviously in the off-season now with London City, so it was nice to be able to get back up home towards Manchester rather than being in London and spend some time with family and friends. Like turn off from football, but then I obviously had a week off and then back into training ready for preparations leading into this upcoming camp. So I need to make sure I'm in the best physical shape, and between the staff at Ireland and obviously club and then my own personal training, I've had enough of a program to be able to get myself in the best possible shape going into the camp if selected. So yeah, I'm in really good position right now, and I'm happy and enjoying my football.
No, that's brilliant to hear. You mentioned linking up with London, and obviously a few Irish already there, and Gray, Sharisha, and Niamh Farrelly. Mid-table finish in WSL2 in a season that has just ended. Is this a place where you could see yourself and get a steady run of games and press on personally?
Yeah, I think for me, before joining London City, I needed regular football. I wanted to get back in and around this and obviously be fit again, and given the opportunity to go to London City was a no-brainer for me. Difficult at the start because obviously I was moving down south where I've never played professionally before. So that was different and an adjustment definitely. But obviously the girls helped massively with that and being around a good group of girls, a good team. And for us at the time when I came in, it was about staying in the league because the new owner, Michelle Kang, had come in and had a project in place to change things. And obviously with ambitions of being in the WSL, in order to do so, we needed to make sure we stayed in that league. So it was stressful, definitely, but another situation I've not been in before with football teams. So, yeah, it was nice to be able to step up as a more experienced player and to help the team through that phase, basically, and get us safe going into next season.
You mentioned Michelle Kang, and I urge any of our listeners to Google Michelle Kang and the story behind her and the US-based businesswoman, because it is amazing. Owner of Washington Spirit, owner of Leon, who are an exceptional football team in the women's game, and now London City Lionesses. It's an amazing story, and listen, yes, there is a debate over multi-club ownership, but this must be an incredibly exciting time to be involved with London City.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can see she's come in a few times since I've been there over the past 4 months and just come in and sharing like her ideas and the project as to where she wants to take that team. And with it being a female-only club, it's massive for her, and the representation within women's sports is she's trying to change the outlook and the science behind like individualising plans for females rather than comparing them to men's and the stats and stuff like that. So for us as players, it's all individualised, and as players, we feel like the support is there 100%. So, yeah, she's got a big project in place for London City. And like I said before, she wants the team in the WSL as soon as possible. And so for us as players, it's a bit of pressure, but it's pressure that you live for. And as a player, that's the situations you want to be involved in. So it's definitely a great place to be right now. And I'm looking forward to next season where it'll be probably a new enough squad, a new manager as well, obviously, with Remy leaving. And it'll bring new challenges, but again, I'm looking forward to it. But first off, I'm looking forward to enjoying my summer at home and hopefully the two international camps that come before that.
Yeah, on the international front then,
plenty of positives to take from the France and England matches, albeit on the wrong end of the result against two top teams. What do you take as a group from those matches that you can go into the Sweden doubleheader with?
I think you've probably seen the progression that we made from the France game to the England game. We played against obviously two top opposition, the European champions and a renowned figure in France who are in the summer going to the Olympics as well. And they were never going to be an easy game for us. And as players, we needed to come together and just, you know, work on our own game plan and take what we could from those games. And unfortunately, we didn't come away with a result in either of them. But you could definitely feel the confidence growing as a team going into the second game against England. And I think from the back end of the game too, I think we did have some good chances and, you know, turned the game in our favour almost in terms of the attitude we had towards wanting to get a result against them. And I think it's a credit to the staff and the players for their commitment and their hard work throughout that camp, but also previous camps to get us in the position to be able to compete with the world's best. I think going into Sweden, obviously, we'll have a bit more experience against playing with them because obviously we did that in the last campaign. So we do have probably a bit more experience against playing Sweden. We'll be looking to impose, obviously, our learnings on them. But I think the most important thing is that we continue to make progress and strides within our own football and within our own team and our own, you know, identity as a team and what we want to get from this campaign. So yes, it's going to be tough regardless. I think the group tells you enough by just reading the names off on the list. It's never going to be easy, but we're taking it game by game and we're looking forward to, obviously, the next two games are against Sweden, home and away, which will bring a different challenge, but one we're looking forward to and hopefully we can relish.
How many points is a realistic target to set for this Sweden doubleheader?
I don't think we look at it in a points situation, and that might be, you might think that that's an easy way of getting out of the question, but I think for us it's about performance, and if the performance is there and the attitude is right and we've got things tactically right and technically right, then I think the result can happen. We can't think too far ahead. We know it's going to be tough regardless, so I don't think points is something that we need to expect going into these games because that's an added pressure that we don't need to put on ourselves. But we know in the back of our minds that we need to get results and we want to finish as high up in the group as possible. But we still have four games left in the group to do so.
Well, I think the improvements in performance and the incremental improvements, and it's going in the right trajectory is quite obvious to see, which is a brilliant thing to see as well. Listen, a lot has been said about your not-so-secret weapon at this stage, that devastatingly dangerous long throw of yours. I'm really curious, has this always been an ability from a young age?
Yeah, probably from about 12 or 13, I was playing with boys down in Drogheda. With Boyne Rovers, and my throw-in was just further than the boys, and they said do that again, and yeah, I think as I grew it got longer, thankfully. It's not something I really trained until I went to America and I did a small bit of work on it in terms of upper body strength, more with throwing med balls and then the ball itself, but overall I've not really, you know, focused too much time on training it. It's just a natural ability which I'm very fortunate to have right now, probably not when I'm about 50 and I can't hold, but for now it's all good.
I say the core strength is ridiculous if you're throwing med balls around.
it's definitely needed anyway.
Going into this group, and you mentioned the squad hasn't been announced yet, one key player for Ireland is of course Katie McCabe. Now, news today, it's been confirmed, she has to jet down to Australia for a post-season friendly match with Arsenal. Eileen Gleeson has said it's far from ideal. I've seen Ireland fans online brand it an utter disgrace. What's your take on the situation?
Obviously I'm not in that personal situation that Katie's in, but I imagine it to not be an ideal situation for her neither, but ultimately Arsenal are her employer and she works for Arsenal, and so when the club outside of an international window wants you to do something, you're contracted to do so, and whether she liked it or not, obviously that was a decision that was made. I know myself, the rest of the team, the staff, and I mean how many Irish fans, everyone will be hoping that and praying that Katie comes back in full fitness going into the camp, which I've no doubt she will, knowing the fact that, you know, she does everything right, she's a top professional and she's not playing at the highest level for no reason. So she knows what's needed to get herself in that position and in that shape, ready for two big tests against Sweden. But yeah, it's important for her right now to be there, and her focus is still with Arsenal until that international window starts. As hard as that is for Irish fans to think about, that's where her commitment lies until the 26th of May.
Yeah, no, that's very fair. Listen, it's a big few weeks ahead for Ireland, for yourself. It is brilliant to hear that you're back at the top of your game, and I wish you the very best of luck if or when you do get selected for the upcoming Ireland squad, and indeed for the summer ahead and the season ahead as well. Megan Campbell, thanks so much for taking the call.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Game on.
Football.
So now on Game On, we are going to turn our attention to cycling, where Tadej Pogacar is dominating the Giro. Sam Bennett rocked the 4 days of Dunkirk, but this week sees the 69th edition of the Ross taking place. And before we talk to Shane Stokes, we're going to hear from last year's winner, Dylan Corkery.
Obviously, for me, winning the race last year has put me in the history books forevermore, you know. I'm on that trophy, you know, like I said, forevermore. And regardless of what I do this year, that's not going to change. I think, you know, there was kind of two or three main reasons why I wanted to come back this year and do it. You know, in addition to winning last year, I mean, having my family there last year was great. You know, it was a big boost for me. Hmm. And I still have my four grandparents and everything. And when I'm at home, they used to follow me around week in, week out. And obviously, when I left for France, that wasn't a thing anymore. So coming back last year and being able to do it was great. You know, yeah. And winning it was just a cherry on top. So, I mean, if I could do it again this year, it'd be super. But I'm not putting any pressure on myself whatsoever. I'm going to focus on a stage again like I did last year. I'm here as a royal captain for the under 23 boys. So obviously, we focus on maybe the white jersey. And look, like I said, if it works out that things play out in my favour, you know, so be it, and if not, it is what it is.
So cycling journalist Shane Stokes joins us this evening on Game On. Dylan Corkery will be at the start in Tullamore along with 15 overseas teams. Do you think it's a good addition, Shane?
Yeah, it looks to be very good. The race wasn't on for a couple of years with sponsorship and then COVID, sponsorship issues and then COVID. So it's getting re-established now, and it's got, again, the same good overseas attendance. It's looking to be a great race. The organisers are building year on year. This year's race is slightly harder than the previous editions, the previous recent editions, and it looks like it's going to be a very good event with, as you say, with Dylan taking part and loads of other Irish riders as well.
Well, it looks hard to me, knowing Irish geography. Tullamore to Kilmallock, Kanturk to Sneem, Kenmare to Kerr, finishing Kildare Town on Thursday, and then Minute to Bective. They're fairly transgressing or trends, whatever the word I'm looking for, going over and back across the country anyway.
Yeah, sure, yeah. And they are covering a fair amount of ground, all right, so between Wednesday and Sunday. It should be a very competitive race as ever. It's the Ross is quite unique because a lot of other races are very controlled. They've got bigger teams and just less chaotic racing, but the Ross has five-man teams. And last year, Conor McGoldrick, an English rider with an Irish name, he's Irish ancestors, he won stage one and tried to lead from start to finish and then got undone on the final day by Dylan Corkery and the Ireland team. So it's a very chaotic race. It's really difficult to control because of the small teams and just the style of racing. It's kind of flat out and it's kind of notorious for that. So it makes it really, really competitive and very interesting.
Nice broad question for you, Shane, and you will be on with us tomorrow to look back on day one, but what are you most looking forward to? What should we be looking out for if you were to pick one thing?
I think that unpredictability for sure. I mean, the Ross, I've covered so many editions of the race, and you could have a day where somebody loses 5 minutes and the next day can gain 6 minutes, which is kind of unheard of in cycling, but that's the kind of race it is. So it's utterly impossible to predict what's going to happen in the race. And I think that's one of the big attractions for us. It's just how aggressive it is and how wild it can get in terms of just tactics and the way the race plays out and the way that the terrain can influence and the weather, you know, because we've had really catastrophic weather at times as well and then sometimes good weather. So, yeah, I think that's the great thing about the Ross is that whole unpredictability of it and that it's exciting right until the last moment.
Well, do you think if I was off air on Saturday at the Curragh around about 4:30, I'd catch him coming into Kildare Town?
I don't have the time schedule right in front of me, but I'll let you know for sure. What I'll do is I'll say it during the week when we're doing the roundup, so I can give you an update on the finishing time. So, yeah.
Sounds good to me, Shane. I hope you enjoy it.
Perfect. Shane Stokes, as I mentioned, we'll be chatting to you again tomorrow. Thanks so much for taking the call. It should be a great event. As I say, starts tomorrow until Sunday, and Ruby will be part of the crowd cheering you on over the weekend as well. So
I tell you, the Corazon Saturday, they're coming into Kildare Town. Why not?
Great day out. Great day out, and a genuinely great event. Ruby, that is all we have time for. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Shane.
Pleasure as
no
always.
No Richmond Park for you tonight.
No
quiet
Richmond
night
Park.
Now, no
quiet evening now. I can recover. I can watch back.
Go
the
watch
highlights.
A replay. Yeah,
I'll watch the highlights back. big thanks to John Farland, Aaron O'Sullivan for working on this evening's show. Betty De Silva is up next, so do not go anywhere. Stay tuned to 2FM. Game On's back from 6 o'clock tomorrow. So from all of the Game On team, it is bye for now.
RTE 2FM.